colourful and quirky, full of character and a sense of fun, however the cause of much mirth, and often goes against common logic and social expectations. Bill Thompson. Fancy walking a mile in Bill Thompson's shoes? Not many would, especially not after hearing what this poor shoemaker come criminal had to put up with. William Bill Thompson was a young shoemaker, transported in 1841 for life for burglary. He was sent to the coal mines, where he worked in appalling conditions, harnessed with three other men to drag loaded coal carts. After 12 months, Bill was relieved to be removed to the shoemaking shop, which also offered many opportunities for private profit. 2 years later, Bill was sent to the Browns River Probation Station, where he soon began trading pilfered soap and boots, usually keeping just one step ahead of the overseers. In late 1844, he was released to find his own employment. He worked for a shoemaker for 4 peaceful years before suddenly being arrested after his employer accused him of spying on his daughter while she was in the lavatory. Bill denied it, but the authorities didn't believe him. He was sent to the treadwheel in the prisoner's barracks for 6 months, hard labour and chains, and then to the Bridgewater Road Gang. He went on to Port Arthur, where he was first assigned to the timber carrying gang, then to the shoemaking shop. After 8 months at Port Arthur, he found work with a master shoemaker in Hobart, where he met his future wife, convict Elizabeth Miller. They married in 1852 and went on to have 7 children and many descendants. In 1900, when he was 80 years old, William Thompson told his story to Tasmanian photographer John Watt Beatty, who photographed Bill as he had looked as a convict. Black Louis, room 315. Black Louis made his fortune when he dug a precious substance out of the carcass of a whale, only to have his fortune stolen from his daughter after he died. Born sometime around 1850, Black Louis Smith lived at Gagans Point in Rechurch Bay. To the locals, a multicultural group of ex-whalers, he appeared to be a South Sea Islander or a West Indian, an uncommon sight in Tasmania in those days. Black Louis and his mate, Black Harry, were fishing near Port Davey when they encountered the crew of Hobart's last whaler, the Water Witch, flensing a sperm whale. The captain was anxious to leave the southern waters for home, so he gave the remains of the rotting carcass to Black Louis and Black Harry. The two crawled inside and, using rusty knives and an axe, extracted thousands of pounds worth of ambergris, a solid waxy mass of undigested beaks of squid used in the production of perfume and church incense. Back in Hobart, they were feted at the wharf as the ambergris weighed in at 180 pounds. On the London market, it was exchanged for 11,000 pounds sterling, the highest price ever for this substance from Australian waters. Harry bought land, a townhouse and a pub, and promptly drank himself to death. Louis bought a fishing boat and a home and an orchard at Southport. He eventually died in 1924, stumbling from a jetty on a stormy night. Cocky Billet, room number 116. Now here's a man with a strong sense of self. Feared fist fighter, champion footballer and dandy dresser, Cocky Billet was truly one of a kind. One night on the Hobart docks, the one-time heavyweight boxing champion of Tasmania, Pat Appleton, was beaten just once in a round or two with Cocky Billet. Aside from his pugilistic prowess, Cocky Billet was also a gifted Australian rules footballer. He won the William Leach Medal in 1930 when playing for the Kinnanore Football Club, the Canaries, in the Tasmanian-Australian National Football League. He was also regarded as the flashiest dresser in Hobart. A tall, handsome man, he wore his dark hair lacquered back with oil, his pork pie hat cocked to one side on a jaunty angle, highly polished two-coloured shoes, and immaculate suits. To add to his unique persona, Cocky wore a bow tie that lit up when he pressed a button. As a joke, an ornate flower pinned to his lapel incorporated the water in the flower trick. Cocky's haunts were the racetracks, the wharf, and the pubs. One night in the Alexander, the wharfies pub, A friend said that he was drinking with Cocky, who was done up in the raincoat and the hat down on one side, up the other, and he's got a scarf like this. God, he could dress. A couple of blokes come in and I went out. When I come back, these blokes are rolling around on the floor and I says, Jesus, Cocky, what happened to them? He looked at me and explained that the gentleman, now bleeding on the floor, had objected to his sartorial tastes. François Fouché, room number 310. Come one, come all, to see the magnificent François Fouché, one of Hobart's greatest showmen. Big Frank was often seen wandering the streets dressed as a vaudeville villain, luring punters into his famous non-licensed dance hall. François Fouché, or Big Frank as he was known, was a professional wrestler by trade. He arrived in Hobart in 1938 for a wrestling tournament. Afterwards, he decided to stay and set up a gymnasium and conduct radio sessions on diet and health. With a commanding physical presence, he was about 188 centimetres tall, big-boned and athletic, weighing about 114 kgs. Intelligent, educated and articulated, with a soft voice and a great sense of fun, Big Frank was a showman. He had been a bodyguard for child screen star Shirley Temple when she toured Hawaii in 1934. He claimed that his father was a French-Canadian cavalry officer and that he himself had graduated from Michigan State University, served as an officer in the United States Army Medical Corps, and competed in an Olympic Games. Along with his gym, he opened the Stage Door, an unlicensed dance hall. To promote it, he would walk the streets of Hobart in costume as a villainous character, tempting people to come to his venue and sample the darker side of life. An altercation at this venue ended in Frank having to physically defend himself, leading to the death of a patron. Even though he was acquitted of manslaughter, his public image was tarnished and led to the closure of his dance hall in 1946. He eventually attempted to build a luxury hotel complex in Old Beach, but fire gutted the building site and he ran into financial difficulty. Graham Payne, room number 232. Who are you laughing at? If you've been around Tassie Theatre for more than a few minutes, chances are you've laughed at Graham Payne. Graham Payne is possibly Hobart's most revered and loved larrikin of the stage. As a 38-year veteran of Tasmania's most revered comedy satire, the Old Nick's Uni Review, Graham has always been consistent in his approach to causing mayhem and producing comedic gold. With his wild ginger hair and unique sense of humour, he regularly draws crowds from all over Tasmania. Graham once had a rival on stage who constantly refuted his attempts to make a mockery of him. Not to be outdone, during one review, while walking on stage in a kilt, Graham took off his underwear. His rival saw him do it and matched Graham's act by taking off his own. As the skit progressed, a fellow actor performed his role of raising both his colleagues' kilts and mimicked placing his hands on their privates to check each gentleman's manhood. Fortunately for Graham, he began the day wearing two pairs of underpants. Unfortunately for his colleague, he did not. The gasps from the crowd and the following laughter bellowed through the walls of the theatre. No one was safe from Graham on stage, although his antics were always in good fun, and it was this colourful playfulness, along with a gift for clever, albeit naughty satire, for which Graham is most admired. For service to the performing arts through a range of live theatre organisations and a passion for supporting the community through theatre, Graham received the Order of Australia Medal in 2009. Henry Hopkins, room number 123. Times were tough in old Hobart Town, so tough that one shopkeeper didn't even provide packages for his products, which were the sort of things that really do need packaging. Think flour, sugar, and tea. The curious tale of Henry Hopkins was first recorded by another Henry, the convict author Henry Savery. When Mr. Savery was in prison, he wrote of an incident that occurred while he was shopping in Elizabeth Street, Hobart, in 1829. It started in Henry Hopkins' shop when he noticed the strange manner in which another customer was being served. The man asked for a pound of sugar, which was weighed and then deliberately turned out upon the counter. The purchaser instantly proceeded to fill his pockets with it. "Do you not provide a wrapper for what you sell?" Henry Savary inquired. Hopkins stroked his chin and with a demure expression replied, "Our profits won't allow paper." A large, middle-aged female with a disheveled appearance approached the shop from a nearby pub. Throwing some money on the counter, she said, "Give me some tea and sugar." Henry Hopkins gave her a quizzical stare and asked, "What have you to put them in, my good woman?" To which this customer replied, "None of your good woman for me," while at the same moment stooping to draw off a dirty stocking from an even dirtier foot. "Here's a legal bear looking at it, and here's something will hold the tea and sugar." She handed over the stocking, into which Mr. Hopkins placed the sugar before he tied it in the middle with the woman's garter so as to form a division for the tea. Eccentricities aside, Henry Hopkins was a primary backer of Tasmania's wool production. His early investment in wool paid extremely handsome dividends to Henry and the industry in general. Ikey Solomon, room number 301. If you're familiar with Fagin, the dastardly character from Oliver Twist, then you'll like Ikey Solomon. It's said that he was the model for Dickens. He said that he was the model Dickens used to create the notorious thief. An East End London convict of Jewish origins, Isaac Ikey Solomons, also known as Solomon, is believed to have been the inspiration for the notorious character Fagin in Charles Dickens' Oliver Twist. Ikey was arrested in 1810 for picking pockets, but he escaped before he could be transported. In 1827, he was arrested but escaped from custody again. Handsome and neatly dressed, Ikey was well known to the police and to the judges of London, but they were unable to locate him. Instead, the police found stolen goods in the Solomon family home. This led to his wife Anne's conviction and transportation, along with their four children, to Van Diemen's Land. Ikey was in Brazil when Anne was transported. Upon hearing the news, he sailed straight to Hobart. Having committed no crime on Vandemonian soil, he could not be arrested, so he opened a shop. As a free settler, Ikey petitioned and paid a bond of £1,000 to have his wife assigned to him. A vexed Lieutenant Governor Arthur eventually received warrants from England for Ikey's arrest. Arthur told the Governor of the Hobart Jail to take long service leave to England and take Ikey with him. In this way, Ikey would never leave the custody of the jail governor. It was a neat legal quirk. Ikey was finally convicted in London and sentenced to transportation to Van Diemen's Land. After serving his time at Port Arthur, he set up a tobacconist shop in Hobart and was a seat holder at the Hobart Jewish Synagogue. Lucky Grills, room number 235. From farmer's son to comedy clown, Leo Lucky Grills entertained Australia in variety shows, stage, film and television for over 50 years. Although a natural comedian, it was his grumpiest role that endeared him to the nation. Born in Hobart just prior to the Depression, the parents of Leo Grills moved the family to a farm in northwest Tasmania soon after his birth. As children, the bleakness accompanying the Depression meant they had to entertain themselves, and for Leo, entertainment turned into a career. A natural clown, soon after World War II, Leo joined an American touring group and toured with them to Melbourne and Sydney. This opened up further opportunities, and he was soon entertaining the troops during the war in Korea. Known by the stage name of Lucky, he joined forces with a friend, Jeff Mack, and the two of them embarked upon a touring show venture. Their success allowed them to buy another travelling company with a 1,000-seat tent. They toured and entertained the country for 6 years. After a number of years performing overseas with his wife Sunny, Lucky took regular roles in films and appeared in a vast number of Australian television shows. In 1971, You Say the Word, a program teaching migrants to speak English, hired Lucky to play the owner of a factory. It was a role he played for several years. In 1976, Lucky took on his standout role, the role of Bluey in the series of the same name. It was a role for which he would always be remembered. Lucky was awarded the Australian Centenary Medal in the 2000 Queen's New Year Honour List and later the Order of Australia Medal in the 2001 Queen's Birthday Honours List. The latter was for his services to the entertainment industry through charitable organisations. Leo Lucky Grills worked consistently until his death, dying in his sleep in 2007. He was 79. Ma Dwyer, room number 303. Well, 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 if it isn't Ma Dwyer, one of the most colourful characters in Tasmania. Famous for her less than legal business, her generous lines of credit, her blue language and her golden soul, she's gone down in Tassie history as a champion of the common people. The reigning publican and rumoured madam of Salamanca Place in the mid-1900s, Elizabeth Ma Dwyer, was the licensee of the Esplanade Hotel, now Irish Murphy's. A notorious haunt for sailors and wharfies, it was better known as the Blue House because of Ma's colourful language and the rampant fights that broke out there. Originally in the stewardship of her husband John, Ma had the license for the Esplanade transferred into her name in 1946. In her role as bartender, she wore fluffy blue slippers in keeping with her pub's nickname. Local sailors and regulars were allowed to drink on credit until payday, and Ma was always generous with free drinks for a hard luck story. She also had some quirky management skills. She rigged up a system of strings tied to the beds in the rumoured brothel above the pub. The strings ran through the floor and were attached to bells so that Ma, who worked the bar below, would know that the girls were working. Her pub license was taken away in 1961 after one too many assaults in her establishment. On Ma's last night at the Esplanade Hotel, Salamanca Place was filled with mourners. Seamen and waterside workers stood outside the hotel holding up a large flag bearing a portrait of Queen Elizabeth between two Union Jacks. The crowd of hundreds stood around her and toasted her, roaring, "She will reign forever." Marie Bjelke Petersen, room number 216. Close the blinds and lock the door, things are about to get steamy. Marie Bjelke Petersen wrote 9 best-selling bodice rippers, so she knows a thing or two about seduction. Marie Bjelke Petersen arrived in Hobart with her Danish family in 1890, where she registered in Tasmania as a physical education teacher and massage therapist. As a young woman, Marie was fair, lithe, and mannish in dress. Later in life, the expensive smart clothes she chose enhanced a graceful femininity. Although she remained a spinster, Marie produced 9 throbbing and pulsating romantic novels, mostly set in Tasmanian mines, bush or caves. Over 250,000 copies of her novels were sold. In that long, motionless kiss, it seemed as if the burning deeps in him had found the tortured deeps in her, and as they came together, they gloriously united, bringing the man and woman who caressed a delirious satisfaction. Marie's excellent physique and passion for accuracy enabled her, notebook in hand, to go on foot, horse, dray, or bullock wagon into remote areas. At Queenstown in the 1920s, she was the first woman to go underground with working miners. She mixed easily with them and with those on the Savage River Osmium fields. Savage River was the setting of her novel, Jeweled Nights, 1924, and it also featured the local vernacular. It was filmed on location by Louise Lovely Productions in 1925. Marie's fondness for whimsy expressed itself through notes to fairies and letterboxes in the garden of her home that she called Moongate at Lindisfarne. Her nephew, Joe Bjelke Petersen, became Premier of Queensland. Max the Sweet, room number 120. We're not saying we believe in every ghost story we hear, and there are plenty of alleged ghosts in Tasmania, but we definitely believe in Max the Sweet. The Shipwrights Arms Hotel, Shippies, in Battery Point was established in 1846 and has had a regular visitor for almost as long. A prankish ghost regularly startles and amuses residents. Max appears as a spooky yet smiley old man with long white hair, moustache and beard, clothed in overalls and a peaked blue cap. When he is about, the temperature drops and the air is permeated with the sweet smell of vanilla. Whalers in colonial Van Diemen's Land often smelled of vanilla due to the fact that they were often coated in sperm whale oil from boiling down the blubber. The oil carried a vanilla scent attained from the ambergris the whalers extracted from their prey. Was Max a whaler like the sailors who frequented the bar at Shippies? These whalers were undoubtedly a pungent bunch. His signature scent as he wafts around the bar certainly adds weight to this theory. Whatever he was in his first life, he must have been mischievous and probably fond of a drink or two. These days, he's often blamed for unexplained lowering of the tide in whiskey and rum bottles. Mrs. Delaney, room number 130. The story of Mrs. Delaney is a tale of quick wit, daring deeds, and the timeless reminder that there's nothing more powerful than a woman in her bloomin'. The irrepressible Mrs. Delaney lived near the railway line at Rhinedaston. Once, during persistent heavy rainfall, she noticed a bridge on the main line had almost washed away, with a train approaching rapidly. Red was the acknowledged signal for danger, but Mrs. Delaney's only access to that colour was an item of her underclothes. Verbal legend has it to have been her bloomers. Whatever the item, Mrs. Delaney removed it and waved it frantically at the approaching train. The startled crew brought the train to a halt, most likely saving the lives of all on board. Mrs. Delaney was rewarded with a free pass for life to travel on all Tasmanian government railways. From then on, she boarded the local trains to sell her fruit and sweets. Her quick thinking was matched by her quick Irish wit. During World War I, two boys teased Mrs. Delaney, saying, "Come on, Mrs. Delaney, come to France with us. Come and help us win the war. Come and look after us." Mrs. Delaney replied, "I might even do that. There's only one condition. I'll clean your rifles, but not your trousers." In 1905, when snow fell and the train stopped at Parata, Mrs. Delaney was one of the first to put down her basket and join in a great snowball fight, breaking a snowball square on the guard's neck. Up to and following her death in 1919, Mrs. Delaney was known throughout the island as a key part of the Rhinedaston and Parata railway legend. Nutsy Harwood, room number 134. Some people are great at making money in honest, legal ways, and others, like Nutsy Harwood, are just as good at earning cash through means a little less scrupulous. Harold John Nutsy Harwood had a colourful career full of many endeavours, not all legal, that began with cycling in 1917 when he was 14 years old. In 1923, a very complimentary article appeared in the Weekly Courier stating that in 1918, young Harwood was a star performer, winning many handicap and scratch events. The article concluded that he was a rider who combined speed with excellent judgment. But by 1927, Nutsy's weight had increased and he gave up competitive cycling. He had a seasonal occupation as a showman in northern Tasmania. He appeared to the patrons as powerfully built, broad-shouldered, bull-necked, with a square head and red face. Spruiking with a booming voice, Nutsy introduced the dancing ducks, unfortunate birds that moved rapidly from one webbed foot to the other above a hidden spirit stove. Nutsy had not shown any interest in politics, but in 1943 he contested the federal seat of Bass, but this curious decision has an explanation. The Minister for Supply and Shipping had announced petrol ration tickets to the value of 200 gallons for candidates for the forthcoming elections for non-metropolitan areas. Nutsy realised that Bass was in a non-metropolitan area, and while he didn't have a car, petrol ration tickets were in demand on the black market during the war. He failed to gain a Bass seat, so to ensure that his petrol ration tickets were not in jeopardy, he nominated as an alderman for the City Council, although he did not own any property. Patsy Mayer, room number 139. Feel like a big night on the town? Or maybe you'd rather a light snack of fruit and nuts. Either way, you've come to the right man, because Patsy Mayer is an expert in both. Although Patrick Patsy Mayer was born in Ireland, he was considered by all to be a Cockney in heart and manner. His convict record labelled him as a bad character. Much of his sentence was spent in the public works gang in Hobart Town. Unfortunately, he could not withstand the temptations of the city and was frequently arrested in brothels or public houses, earning short periods of solitary confinement and longer periods of hard labour. After gaining his ticket of leave in 1856, Patsy moved to Wapping at the lower end of the Hobart Rivulet, an area regarded by Hobart's respectable citizens as the city's slum. Patsy established himself as a fruitier in the Costa tradition of London, selling his wares from a cart drawn by a donkey which he referred to as the horse. Patsy worked hard. His business prospered and he married and was able to buy a house at 13 Sackville Street, Wapping. He then sold fruit and nuts during performances at Theatre Royal, where he was remembered as the raucous-voiced old Costa, who for years pushed his way through pit and gallery, shouting monotonously, "Grapes, oranges, bull nuts, who says jaw tackle?" For many years, he was as much a part of Hobart's theatre as its stage. There was much goodness in Patsy, though he was boisterous and erratically violent at times. He redeemed his early errors, and his career shows how anyone can, even in this humble fashion, rise from his dead self to better things. Reverend Knopwood. Van Diemen's Land is no ordinary place, and its first clergyman was no ordinary reverend. Bobby Knopwood was a colourful, kind and deeply flawed man who meticulously recorded his experiences, which has proved invaluable to historians. Room number 147. Van Diemen's Land's first clergyman and magistrate, Bobby Knopwood, arrived in 1804. He was heavily in debt and looking for a new life in the colonies. Most importantly to historians, he recorded his life in his diaries, something nobody else did at the time. These diaries are invaluable, a rare, insightful account of the formative years of the colony. He recorded the hardships and brutality, his hunting and fishing expeditions, the sermons he preached, interactions with the local Aboriginal people, the weather and shipping news, and his many social engagements. He was also a notable member of society in the colony, both high and low. He was granted large tracts of land, served as magistrate of the colony, oversaw a large parish, adopted an orphaned girl, and often dined at Government House, as well as many pubs and drinking houses of much lower reputation. Henry Savary, the author of Australia's first novel, described him as an elderly parson in a straight-cut, single-breasted coat with an upright collar, a clergyman of the old school, remarkably mild and placid countenance, manner easy and gentlemanly in the extreme, conversation lively and agreeable, a choice spirit. After falling into debt and out of favour with Lachlan Macquarie, the governor, he was semi-exiled to Rokeby on the eastern shore in 1817. His salary was slashed and all his properties were confiscated, aside from his land at Rokeby. He died there in 1838. Thomas Dewhurst Jennings, room number 228. We'd give you a warning, but we're sure you've already seen him coming. It's Thomas Dewhurst Jennings himself, the biggest man in Australia and one of the most colourful characters you'll ever meet. But don't just look at him, go have a chat. He's even larger than life. On the 6th of May 1884, Thomas Dewhurst Jennings made headlines in the Brisbane Courier, who claimed he was the biggest man in Australia. In the 1880s, he weighed 32 stone and was 5 feet 10 inches tall. Prior to being licensee of the Harvest Home Hotel on Newtown Road, Thomas had been the licensee of the Derwent Inn, as well as the Risdon Ferry and punt operator. He was so popular that when he visited mainland Australia, he caused a sensation, being wined and dined at receptions in his honour. He had free admission to all manner of public events in the hope that his very substantial presence would increase ticket sales. On one occasion, two gentlemen were seated in the Theatre Royal for a performance. The first man said to his friend, "I'll bet you that Jennings comes to the theatre tonight." The other could not see why Thomas should turn up on that particular occasion and agreed to a bet. A few minutes later, in walked Thomas. "Now how in the name of goodness did you know Jennings was coming?" asked the second man. "Why," said the winner, "didn't you notice that both folding doors were thrown open? They never do that except when Jennings comes." Thomas Wainwright, room number 106. The topsy-turvy life of Thomas Wainwright featured dizzying highs and deplorable lows, which goes to show that you should never take things for granted. Thomas Griffiths Wainwright was born into a well-to-do family in 1794, but was unfortunately orphaned at a young age. He was raised by his grandfather and uncle and received a good education. As a young man, he became well known as an author, an artist, and a dandy, travelling the same circles as Charles Dickens, Charles Lamb, and Thomas de Quincey. In 1817, he married a wealthy woman, and his life seemed very comfortable, but he was soon living well beyond his means and began forging cheques to maintain his lifestyle. A cloud of suspicion later descended on Thomas when his uncle, mother-in-law, and sister-in-law all died, leaving money to Wainwright and his wife. An investigation could not prove his guilt conclusively, but did turn up evidence of his previous forgery and, in a dramatic turn for the worse, he was transported to Van Diemen's Land. He endured a brutal journey aboard a crowded hulk across the seas, and when he arrived, he was assigned to work on a chain gang. The only thing that kept him going through this ordeal was his painting, which he did at every possible opportunity. Eventually, his skill was noticed and he was loaned out by the authorities as a portrait artist, a much more pleasant punishment than toiling away in chains. As the years went by, his health deteriorated, but he wasn't granted a pardon until 1846. He died only a year later in St. Mary's Hospital, Hobart. William Brown and the Underground Ball, room number 205. You haven't really partied until you've partied in a giant underground ballroom, in a mine until 4 in the morning, at Ringarooma. Deep in the Ringarooma mine there was a huge underground chamber which was intended to house an electrical plant. One day a workman suggested that the chamber would be a splendid place to have dance. William Brown, the mine manager, loved the idea and took it upon himself to organise Tasmania's first underground ball, an event that would be talked about for generations. Invitations were sent out and were eagerly accepted. Men employed on the mine volunteered to put down a temporary floor for the dancing, while ladies decorated the chamber. Flags were requisitioned and varicoloured drapery hung overhead. A coat of arms was displayed in a conspicuous position on a wall, Chinese lanterns lit up the space, and William Brown's piano was trucked through the tunnel without being scratched or damaged. On Thursday, the 4th of May, 1899, about 80 guests arrived. To reach the chamber, they wended their way through 1,100 feet of tunnel, carefully planked to keep them as dry as possible. Candles lit at regular intervals made the negotiation easy. Everything went to plan. The dancing began at 8 o'clock and continued, interspersed with songs, until midnight. Supper was then served, and after a time of rest, dancing resumed. The gathering broke up at 4 a.m. William Brown was thanked for the profuse hospitality extended towards the guests, with thanks also accorded to the ladies for all that they had done to contribute to the success of this most beautiful and privileged event. William Brown died suddenly and unexpectedly in 1905, but his underground ball continued to be the talk of the region for years to come. William Buckley, room number 319. William Buckley inspired the saying, "Buckley's Chance," after surviving a situation that would have been the end of most people. The Australian vernacular phrase, "you've got Buckley's," which means it's as good as impossible, is generally considered to have originated with the life of William Buckley. On Sunday the 6th of July in 1835, a bearded giant of a man wearing animal skins and carrying spears emerged from the bush at Indent Head on Port Phillip Bay, Victoria, to surrender to John Batman's advanced landing party. His name was William Buckley. Long assumed dead, he had lived for 32 years with the native Wathaurong people. Before that, he was a convict. In 1803, Buckley escaped from Port Phillip before the transportees were moved on to Van Diemen's Land. He took a spear from an Aboriginal grave to help him walk, a lucky decision. When a group of Wathaurong Aborigines discovered him, they believed that he was the warrior Murungurk, the owner of the spear, returned from the dead, Buckley became a Wurtherong tribesman, learning to hunt and fish and speak their language. When he surrendered, Buckley had forgotten how to speak fluent English and was eventually identified by the tattoo on his arm. He was awarded a pardon and John Batman employed him as an interpreter. By late 1837, William Buckley had become disenchanted with society and left for Van Diemen's Land, where he lived for the next 19 years, working as a constable and as an assistant storekeeper at the Dunurn Female Home. Willie Waskus, room number 211. If you're easily offended, cover your ears now. Willie Waskus, the bloody swearing chemist of Jeeveston, is rather fond of a bit of blue language. The bloody swearing chemist, Bill Travaskes, aka Willie Waskus, was a good-human larrikin pharmacist who served the Jeeveston community for 51 years, dispensing medicines and advice on all topics any hour of the day or night. He arrived in Jeeveston with his new wife Marjorie at the end of the Second World War. His turn of phrase and language was never considered by the locals to be politically incorrect, just colourful, witty and amusing. The nuns from the local Sacred Heart Convent always shopped in pairs. As they entered the Jeeveston Pharmacy, Bill cheerfully greeted them with, "Oh, here come the crows." The pharmacy was the sole supplier of condoms in the town, and Bill enjoyed dealing with the shy young men who were too nervous to approach a female assistant. "Hand me down the shag box," the swearing chemist would call out as the customer squirmed. He also served as a local magistrate. At the beginning of one winter, Willie sentenced a homeless man to 6 months in jail so that the gentleman would be warm, dry, and fed. Willie was also a dab hand at the violin. He played well-known classical tunes by ear. If he could master a tune, he declared the violin was a bloody bastard fiddle if he couldn't master a tune. The interior of his 1950s-style pharmacy, with lines of green apothecary bottles, did not change for decades. By the 1990s, when computers needed to be installed, Bill was in his 80s. He claimed he had met his Waterloo.